are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, May 23rd, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Miles Komf-Lassen, the web editor at In These Times, is going to explain to us the endless series of reasons why absolutely nobody should listen to what the disgraceful former mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, has to say about literally anything. Why this man's absolutely abominable career embodies the absolute worst, not only of the Democratic Party, but of all American elites. He's trying to rebrand himself or set up a new gig, and successfully he's at the Atlantic and ABC News. But we're going to talk about Emanuel's record. Donald Trump tells Democrats it's oversight or legislating. As Wells Fargo and TD Bank have already given Trump finance-related documents to Congress. HUD is going to strip protections for transgender teens or transgender people. Transgender protection at homeless shelters. The global far right strengthens its gains after an unexpected win in Australia. Far right Narendra Modi pulls off a convincing re-election in India, and bad news for minorities. And actually, in fact, despite his rhetoric, the poor in that country. U.S. officials plan to send 10,000 troops to the Midwest as Mattis, who, remember his record in Fallujah, has made his first public remarks since leaving the Trump administration to warn against a military strike in Iran. Workers at McDonald's are striking across the country today for a high $15 minimum wage and against sexual harassment. Bernie Sanders is standing with them in Dallas today as we speak, even as his campaign has used their email list to support that protest and giving money to grassroots abortion organizations. While teaching at Harvard, Senator Elizabeth Warren did outside legal work. Some of that was very bad, including Dow Chemical defending itself against breast implants that blew up in women's chests, and on behalf of LTV Steel in their battle against the United Mine Workers and raiding their pensions. Not good. The DeVos family ends its longtime support of Justin Amash after he comes out for the impeachment of Donald Trump. Paraguay prosecutes campesinos who protested soy and agrochemicals. Leaked Proud Boys chat show members plotting violence at rallies. And Lula da Silva, the world's most prominent political prisoner, gives an hour-long interview to Glenn Greenwald in The Intercept, where he talks not only about his unjust imprisonment, but gives a sense of how the history of globalization, how to defeat the global far right. And in news that might make Matt uncomfortable, the Pentagon finally admits that it's investigating UFOs. A big legal win for Meek Mill.
They admit
Mill.
That every 5 years. I feel
like. Yeah, you're right. Big legal win for Meek Mill in Philadelphia. And the European Union votes in Eurozone elections today. Will it be a victory for the fascist forces? Will there be an unexpected breakthrough for the populist left? And where does Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party stand in this? All that and more on today's Majority Report. We, the four of us, are here. Sam obviously is not. And
the millennials are here.
The millennials are back. The millennials are back.
It's the Millennial Report.
It's the Millennial Report. Sam is the quintessential Gen Xer.
He sure is.
That's amazing. But yet still claims to not know who Ace of Base is. Howard Stern has a new book out kind of a book, I think, that sort of, I guess, reflects his new, basically on satellite radio, the guy sort of reinvented himself. He's gone from sort of like a, I guess kind of like a 80s and 90s shock jock to like a, almost like a earthy Terry Gross. Incredible. He really is. Like, guy is amazing interviewer.
That's so weird.
I mean, I think he's, I'm a big Howard Stern fan from everything. I think he's funny and I like all the old stuff. I sometimes will go on a binge where I'll listen to like 90s Howard Stern.
You like listening to him beg to see women's tits for half an hour? That's fun for you?
Yeah, sure.
It's nostalgia.
If that helps the bit. No, that actually isn't most of what that content is. I like him like bothering Jackie the Joke Man about his various career schemes as an example. So, and I also, my favorite thing, and I am someone who should not be laughing at this, but his station manager, Tom Chiasano, sent a company-wide memo and it had a lot of grammar errors in it. So Howard had a second grade school teacher from Long Island named Mrs. D'Agostino, I think her name was, come into studio and grade the paper on air while he terrorized the station GM. And that is one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life. And that like holds up from the 90s.
That's like something Sam would do.
That is exactly like, well, where do you think Sam gets ideas like this from? It's not like Sam was listening to those, you know, to Howard as well. But anyways, there was actually something relevant that happened to Stern, I guess, politically back in like 2003, 2004, where the FCC was definitely fining him in a way that was specifically targeted to him, and it did have free speech implications, and it also was in a context of total vertical integration of the media landscape. And at that point, it was radio under the dominance of Clear Channel, which incidentally was also like incredibly xenophobic, pro-war, pro-Bush. They weren't playing the Dixie Chicks because the Dixie Chicks had some mild criticism of George W. Bush. I mean, as Sam says, it truly was. Now is so crazy, of course, but there is an alternative. There is an ecosystem that's accessible where you can share a community. Whereas, like, people really do. I mean, back then, going and reading like the blogosphere to get the alternative perspective was really people who were just like, "Yeah, I'm a Democrat. I don't want to cut Social Security. I don't think that we should just sort of like torture and murder people in the Middle East." So, but Stern was fined steadily, and those fines did increase as in that point, you know, not radically, but he became an outspoken supporter basically of Democratic candidates and of John Kerry and against George W. Bush. And Bernie Sanders plays into this. So we got a little bit of a clip, and then we're going to go in a trip down memory lane. But here is Howard Stern on Stephen Colbert explaining his giving a sense of his history with Bernie. And then we have a throwback clip, I think from 2004, 2005, of Sanders on Howard's show. Here is Stephen Colbert with Howard Stern from last night.
Who would you be excited to have on?
Oh, gee, I don't know. That's
Joe Biden.
Sure, why not? Because Joe Biden's had a fascinating life.
Sure.
And I think it would be interesting.
Bernie.
I mean, Bernie Sanders, for sure. You know, Bernie Sanders is probably my biggest hero for one reason, and this is very self-serving. When the FCC was attacking me and they were attempting to take me off the air, and in a big way, it was almost like racketeering. They kept fining our stations. They kept keeping us from buying other radio stations. Bernie Sanders got up in the Senate and said, "I think what you're doing to Howard Stern is wrong. I believe in freedom of speech, and I want to go on record as saying you got to stop it." And it was pretty damn impressive. And I'll tell you, I was under siege at that point. I really was, and I thought it might be the end of my career. And
what year are we talking about here?
Oh, geez. I don't even remember when he did it. I would have
1963.
No, a little later than that. Probably in the 90s.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So he really doesn't remember. So this is actually 2005, and this is a clip. And this is great because I do love, and again, I am a Howard Stern fan, but I do love the collision in this clip of, you know, and fair enough, I totally, yeah, like no one wants their career under siege, absolutely. But I do love like Howard's fairly specific focus and Bernie's broader focus. Check this out.
Government doesn't need to do a thing. You can do it yourself.
Congressman Bernie Sanders from Vermont, I don't mean to sound paranoid, but ever since I announced my satellite deal, I am now seeing the focus going to satellite radio as opposed to terrestrial radio. Am I the target of every politician?
No, I don't think you're the target. I think there's an effort on the part of the extreme right-wingers and people who think that because they don't like something, nobody in America should be able to hear it and see it. It's not just you.
You're the only congressman that I know of. I'm going to tell you about this guy right here on the phone, Bernie Sanders. He proposed a bill to prevent the government from censoring the content of cable TV shows and internet websites.
Yeah, I read about this yesterday.
Yep. His bill was in response to the recently approved House legislation increasing the FCC indecency fines. Which
it's in response to exactly what you talked about. It seems to me, A, it's unconstitutional. The government does not have a right to get into cable. And number two, if people are paying for what they want to see, they have a right to see it. And all of this is about, Howard, is moving us to a less free society in many respects. Cutting out different points of view. If people don't like your program, anybody else's program, you know what they could do? They could turn it off.
I just read about a religious broadcaster that was fired this week because he went on and said, someone asked him, do you think the Pope will go to heaven? It was a theoretical discussion. And the guy said something about how only born-again Christians can go to heaven, you know, whatever his opinion
whatever was. Whatever his belief is.
He was fired for that.
That's right.
Now, if you, and then the guy even said, yeah, the district goes, gee, I never did anything like Howard Stern. Why are they firing me? Because it doesn't stop with me. They're going to censor Tony Soprano. They're going
That's
to censor...
exactly what they're going to do. Let me tell you what they're already doing. I don't know if you know this. You've seen the film Saving Private Ryan, right?
Yeah. Right.
Fantastic film.
Right.
ABC showed it nationally on Veterans Day. 60 ABC affiliates refused to put it on the air because they were afraid they were going to be fined.
6-0.
6-0 because, obviously, in the middle of a war in the film, soldiers use profanity. The PBS could not recently put it, a film distributed, because in the middle of the war in Iraq, bombs are going off. Soldiers use profanity. They had to censor that.
Well, here's the key question. How many of your fellow congressmen, who I'm actually losing respect for, how many of your fellow congressmen are going to support your bill?
Now, so far we've got about 10 on the bill. It's H.R. 1440, but I think... when the American people learn what's going on and the fact that The Sopranos and every other show that they like on cable could be censored, then more and more people will be supporting this bill. But we need the help of the American people.
This was a really big deal at the time, and they were absolutely right. I totally agree with him, but but even just the consistency in terms of, like, from the big argument today about reclaiming America from the oligarchy back to, like, look, if you want to listen to Howard make a total prick of himself, that should be your right. And I think if people wake up, they demand a lot of consistency.
Can we
to
fast
it.
Forward to the part where Bernie rides the Sibian?
I remember I was driving to Burlington. Jenny McCarthy had promised to ride the Sibian for the last three appearances. She hadn't done it.
All of a sudden,
I thought it was about to finally happen. Then it goes silent because they decide what I can and cannot hear. So, in conclusion, Mr. Speaker, Baba Booey, Howard Stern is the king of all media. We love you, Robin. I was watching Black Monday, which is, I don't know what I think of that show. Have you seen it at all? The Don Cheadle?
Yeah, I wanted to. I watched every episode of it, and it kind of loses track of what it's trying to do.
That's the problem, is I don't think it knows what it wants to do, but there is that. There's one character who's having, like, a big, like, F it moment, and after, like, a bunch of, like, increasingly disastrous calls to, like, various friends and family, basically telling them to, you know, kiss off, it concludes with, like, hey, Howard, can, like, Robin take her shirt off? Which I just thought was, like, a really good, like, yeah, that probably was exactly the time. So sometimes you get home after work or school or wherever it may be, and you're too exhausted to do anything. You're knocked out. And you just, maybe you're even still at the office. Maybe you're working late. Maybe it's like a Tuesday. We do TMBS on Tuesday, and it's basically an uninterrupted day that basically goes from, like, I don't know, would you say like 10 to 10:30 or something like that? That's basically a Tuesday. You might want to treat yourself to a meal you deserve with an on-demand from your favorite restaurant with DoorDash. DoorDash connects you with all of your favorite restaurants in your city. Just use the DoorDash app to choose what you want to eat, and your Dasher will bring it right to you wherever you are. With over 310,000 amazing restaurants in over 3,300 cities across the U.S. and Canada, DoorDash lets you order from your favorite local go-tos as well as favorite chains like Chipotle and Cheesecake Factory. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash. Right now, our listeners can get $5 off of their first order of $15 or more when you download DoorDash app and enter promo code Majority Report. That's $5 off your first order when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter promo code Majority Report. Again, that's Majority Report for $5 off of your first order from DoorDash. And whether it's a trail of muddy footprints or a pile of dishes after your first barbecue, nothing cleans the spring scents. Nothing cleans like the spring scents from Grove. Grove delivers natural brands to you that you love, like Mrs. Meyer's, Seventh Generation, Burt's Breeze, and Grove straight to your doorstep. I use Mrs. Meyer's in my apartment. It does really smell good. Everything is healthier for you and the planet, plus it really works. I use all Mrs. Meyer products, hand soap, dish detergent, and not only does it smell really good, like as an actual good smell, not just like a chemical smell that like lingers over your kitchen after you clean dishes. I have super sensitive skin and I have to like wear gloves and everything, but the Mrs. Meyer's helps when you have to, cause I don't have a dishwasher in my apartment. So you get a crank through them and it helps to have a clean product like that. Right now, our listeners can take advantage of this exclusive spring offer. When you place your first order of $20, get a free three-piece cleaning set, your favorite limited edition scent, lilac or mint or peony. That includes a Mrs. Meyer's hand soap, a Mrs. Meyer's spring soap, a Mrs. Meyer's spring multi-surface spray, a Grove Collaborative cleaning caddy, and a Grove Collaborative walnut scrubber sponges. Plus get a 60-day VIP membership as well as a surprise bonus gift. Just go to grove.co/majority to sign up and place an order for 20 or for more or 20 or more. That's grove.co.com. grove.co/majority. That's grove.co/majority. We're going to take a brief break and we're going to come back and talk about the awfulness that is Rahm Emanuel's politics.
Slow times, stranger, there are
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Miles Kampf-Lassen. He's an editor and writer for In These Times, and he's author of the recent piece, which everybody should read. No one should ever listen to anything Rahm Emanuel has to say about politics. Miles, thanks so much for doing this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I'm guessing certainly in this audience, there's probably a fair amount of people that, you know, even if they would know Rahm Emanuel's name, they probably also know that his politics and record are, you know, atrocious from the perspective of, you know, human beings and, you know, advancing important causes like healthcare, education, police reform, and so on. But your piece, I mean, it's a user's guide to a really, really bad politician and also investment banker, in fact. But it's also someone that you can kind of use. I mean, this is one of the few people, and certainly one of the few people that isn't like a former president, you know, that you can use to chart the modern ideological trajectory of all of the wrongs of the Democratic Party. I mean, this is a guy, you know, in some ways, especially if you take it back to the 90s, I can only really think of Bill Clinton or Joe Biden that you could use in this way. So, how did Rahm Emanuel get his start? Where is he coming from? And how does he get into politics?
Sure. Well, I think you're exactly right in that analysis. If there was ever a personification of kind of the neoliberal centrist vision that has dominated the Democratic Party in recent decades, it's Rahm Emanuel. This is someone who got their start working. Actually, so let's go on a little tour of Rahm Emanuel's pretty disastrous political career. He got his start actually doing fundraising. And that might not seem pernicious, but he helped to really engineer this new approach that the Democrats took starting in the 90s, focusing almost exclusively on fundraising and trying to get the support of wealthy interests. And he did that working on Bill Clinton's campaign before the 92 election. He famously helped to stuff out some of the accusations from Jennifer Flowers by doing this massive ad buy for Bill Clinton in the throes of the campaign. And then after Clinton won, he went on to serve as an advisor. And there he carried out some of the really most disastrous policies that we are dealing with the consequences of today, the main one being NAFTA. He helped to write the North American Free Trade Agreement, and that's a bill that, as we know, not only helped to fuel the offshoring of American jobs, but it actually led to really the collapse of the American manufacturing center, helped to gut the industrial Midwest, the Rust Belt, and it led to massive wage stagnation. And this is the type of results we're seeing now that have led to so much stress and depression in these states. So that's number one. He also worked on the crime bill, which helped to incite the mass incarceration crisis. He really pushed Clinton to move to the right of the Republicans on the issue of immigration. He actually, one quote he had giving advice to Clinton was to claim and achieve record deportations of criminal aliens. So that was in 96. So Emanuel's really at the center of a lot of these issues that led the Democratic Party to tack rightward. He left the Clinton administration in 98, then went to Wall Street, as you mentioned, he served as an investment banker. He made $16 million within the course of just a few years. As I note in the piece, that's more than 10 times what an average American will make over their entire lives. He made in just a few years. So he's firmly in the 1%, which helped lead to his moniker of Mayor 1% once he came to Chicago. But from Wall Street, he went and joined the DCCC, DTRIP, and served as its chair. And in 2006, he's credited with helping to orchestrate the election of Democrats to take over Congress in that year's elections. But what he actually did was he recruited all these conservative blue dog Democrats. And these were Democrats that didn't even believe in the issues Democrats supposedly were fighting for, from Wall Street regulation to health care. The list goes on and on. And a lot of these blue dogs aren't even there anymore because they got swept out of office from the Tea Party rise in 2010. So at the moment, it seemed like, oh, Rahm Emanuel, this master of politics, but ultimately it really served to hurt the party, because the party then got known for engaging in all the type of elitist behavior that Rahm Emanuel now is railing against. So then after that, of course, he joined Obama as chief of staff there. He told Obama not to pursue Obamacare, not to pursue health care reform because it was too tough. He fought against union workers during the auto bailout, he famously said, at the UAW. And he really served as a conservatizing force within the Obama administration. And from there, he parachuted back into Chicago, where he won the election for mayor in 2011. And since then, he has pushed this neoliberal approach to governance, whether it's, you know, through privatizing public services, cutting and shutting down public education and mental health, getting massive tax giveaways to tax credit giveaways to corporations, to defending a really abuse-ridden police department. He has just carried out the same type of approach to governance in Chicago. So from, you know, the very early beginnings to today, I think we can see that Rahm Emanuel's approach to politics has been a real failure, for especially for working people, but is also being discredited. I mean, that's what's so incredible right now, is we're seeing right in Emanuel's hometown of Chicago, we just saw the election of six open Democratic socialists who ran not on trickle-down economics, Emanuel's approach, but on taxing the rich and investing in social programs and changing the role of public elected officials to actually focus on democracy rather than just helping wealthy interests. So that's a little encapsulation of the career arc of Mr. Emanuel.
So that's the positive news. And that's also the reason that we still need to keep track of this guy, because, you know, again, I mean, he was exceptionally destructive because he was a destructive force as in the Clinton administration, a destructive force in the National Democratic Party, a destructive force in the Obama administration, and then somebody who really, I mean, and I do want to talk specifically about Laquan McDonald. I want to talk specifically about the war on teachers and public education, because I also think, in fact, that the Chicago's teachers union on the countervailing side of that dynamic is in some way some of the, they're also some of the progenitors of, you know, this much more, you know, this very positive democratic socialist and authentically progressive politics that has been emerging in the last several years. But I mean, before we get, there's two things I want to get to before we get there. And one is, I think it's actually really important to also go back and look at figures like Emanuel in the 90s, because right now the sort of tool of people say in the, you know, on the, in the, for lack of a better word, whatever, say the corporate ring of the Democratic Party or the Clinton campaign in 2016, I think in some odd atmospheric ways what Biden is trying to do, and certainly what other kind of conservative Democratic candidates are trying to do, is somehow claim, and this also, you know, this obviously really began with all of this sort of propaganda efforts against Sanders in 16, that there is a conflict between advancing so-called social justice issues versus, you know, the so-called economic issues, right? And of course, obviously, these policies are very intertwined and interconnected. They're distinct, but they're connected. And there was this, you know, notion that, you know, that was the, you know, exemplified in the most extreme, ludicrous way of, you know, Hillary Clinton doing something about Wall Street won't do something about racism, right? And of course, it's like, well, first of all, that's just insane, because nobody is saying that, nobody's making that argument, but it still is something that should be done. And oh, and incidentally, as a second order thing, actually, a lot of predatory Wall Street policies are, in fact, highly racialized. And the complete elimination of housing wealth had a massive structural racial effect on Black and Hispanic communities. Rahm Emanuel's career really demonstrates that the origins and the politics that, you know, gave birth to the Clintons and Biden, but even people who were, you know, certainly not as bad, but playing in the same playing field, whether or not it be Obama or a, you know, a, I would certainly say a Buttigieg or a O'Rourke or a Gillibrand, that the origins of it, and in fact, Gillibrand's a good example. When she was in the House, she voted against immigration reform. She voted for guns. She voted for tough crime bills, not to mention all the Wall Street votes. That in the 90s, it was not just moving to the corporate direction on economics. It was playing to a huge amount of reactionary sentiments on immigration and welfare. And that's another area where Rahm was a huge promoter of that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, he, what I didn't mention before, one of the other major bills he pushed through under Bill Clinton was welfare reform. And that is, as we know now, and as how progressive economists knew then as well, it spiked extreme poverty. It cut off a lifeline, as I say, in the piece to millions of Americans who that was their basic safety net, you know, and as a result of ending welfare as we know it, the result was that the struggling families were left out in the cold, and that was orchestrated again by Emmanuel. And you bring up an important point. We can't avoid the fact that we have to call these policies what they are, and that's racist.
Right.
And it's because they were not, people say, you know, there's disproportionate effects of certain policies. These policies were meant in order to, they were meant to punish poor people of color. Right. There's no other.
That's welfare reform. It's pure racism. Pure racism.
And you could say the same thing about the school closures here in Chicago that that took place. I mean, 50 public schools at the time, the largest single school closing in American history happened under Emmanuel. And these were mostly in poor black and brown neighborhoods. And so the students that were affected were the same students that are being left out of that type of economy that Rahm Emanuel was trying to build in Chicago, which is meant to replicate Silicon Valley and San Francisco, and is not meant to invest in the very neighborhoods that need it the most. So when we, you know, and the similar thing is true in terms of the policing programs that Emanuel has, you know, he wrote a New York Times op-ed that we should say the occasion for many of this dunking on Rahm is that he is now moved over to a career as a pundit.
Well, I want to get to that. I actually do want to get to that in a minute and treat it in its own terms. But maybe before we get there, get specifically into the Chicago record, and maybe you could talk specifically about the torture program that was revealed in the Chicago PD and Rahm's role in the circumstances surrounding the police murder of Laquan McDonald.
Sure. So the torture element is years ago, there was a torture scandal here in Chicago that was uncovered, and essentially the CPD was torturing black men and doing it in a very orchestrated fashion. This was not some one-off thing. It was orders were coming down from on high. Actually, this was an area where there was some reckoning with the past. And now, as a result of a bill that was pushed through, there is the facts of this torture scandal are being taught in Chicago public schools, which is a pretty incredible thing. But the fact is that we haven't moved so far from those days of, you know, truly vile racist policing, because as we saw in the Laquan McDonald case, there was really no doubt that there was some type of a cover up. How involved Emmanuel was in that cover up is still being debated. But Laquan McDonald was a black teenager who was murdered by the Chicago police. He was shot 16 times while just wielding a knife. He was shot by an officer named Jason Van Dyke. Van Dyke got charged with murder. The murder charge came out just before the videotape of the killing was released to the public, which, you know, you can extrapolate what the ramifications of that are. And upon the release of the video, Chicago erupted in protests, specifically the black community did. And they shut down Michigan Avenue, and protests reigned over the streets for weeks on end, because this was not a one-off thing. I mean, Gary McCarthy, the superintendent of police that had been appointed by Emmanuel, who ended up running against him actually in this past mayoral election before dropped out, Gary McCarthy had overseen this stop and frisk program in Chicago. And we were, you know, victims of the same type of policies that we saw happening in New York under Michael Bloomberg, where people of color were stopped and often arrested for no real reason. And police brutality is still a true issue. I mean, when the Justice Department came in and did a survey of the police department here, they found rampant abuse and issued that in a report. And yet Rahm has not been willing. He had not been willing to go forward through a consent decree, and people were understandably not just angry at him. There was real people demanding his head, basically saying, you know, Rahm has got to go. There were so many chants of resign Rahm. And I think that that was a major reason why he decided not to run for election for a third term, because the political terrain was just so unfriendly to towards him because of that cover up and the scandal. That is not the only reason, though. I mean, it's also that the politics of the city have changed, and we can see that in the results of the election, where all this whole host of progressive candidates from city council to the mayor got swept into office. I mean, it's a clear repudiation of the type of approach Emmanuel had staked his whole political career on.
Absolutely. And so now that gets us to what he's trying to do now. And we'll get to this piece in The Atlantic with one of the most just incredible article titles imaginable from Rahm Emanuel. But, you know, first of all, okay, so he's out. He's in that kind of classic position, I think, of particularly a modern Democrat, where Democratic elite politician, where he's actually incredibly unpopular with constituencies. His record, and I just also want to add the other thing, in 2006, when he was, you know, at you know, running Democratic strategy for the DCCC, he was, you know, he had been somebody who had supported the invasion of Iraq as well. So that's another area that I just think it's worth noting, another, you know, horrific catastrophe that he was the wrong side of. But, you know, going beyond that, someone like Ed Rendell, you know, hack, you know, 1% style Democrat, natural gas Democrat, governor of Pennsylvania. He may, you know, he was a pundit for many years. It's a very expected track. And obviously people like this find a home at, whether it's MSNBC or NBC or wherever. You know, this is a perspective that, you know, people want to hear at Aspen or Davos. It really doesn't matter whether or not the policy was successful or popular, or, you know, maybe it was successful in the sense that what it really is about is, you know, increasing inequality and things like that. But so it's not just that Rahm is doing this and becoming another kind of garden variety pundit, and he's already proven himself to be particularly, you know, odious. He's one of his first things kind of out of the gate was attacking Ilhan Omar, you know, when the Republican jihad against her was at its most vicious. And yes, I did use that word consciously. But it's also that he's come out and wrote this column for The Atlantic called "It's Time to Hold American Elites Accountable for Their Abuses." What is he trying to do as one of the most, both an elite himself and a totally elite-serving politician? What is he writing an apology and documenting all of the failures of his career and announcing that he's going to go to a monastery? Or what else is he doing, if not that?
Well, no, I definitely don't think there's any sign of apology. I mean, the only what, you know, what I was just talking about in terms of the anger towards Rahm Emanuel among the citizenry of Chicago, that has not gone anywhere. People here, you know, coming from Chicago, people here remember. And it was really the activism specifically of black youth who organized incessantly and stopped, it'll go to every Rahm Emanuel public event and shout him down and try to make him confront his crimes against the working class poor communities of color in the city. What Rahm Emanuel doesn't talk about that in his Atlantic article. In fact, the only reference to Rahm Emanuel's role in any of this he gives himself in that Atlantic piece you reference is talking about working under Obama and saying that he pushed Obama to go after the bankers more and that he was ultimately right.
I see.
That's his rewriting of history. He's not taking any accountability for his role in creating this system wherein people are rightfully furious at elite rule in American society, nor is he recognizing the fact that he himself is the ultimate manifestation of that elite nature in which people, you know, decide other people's lives for them because they are rich and wealthy and powerful and well-connected. I mean, that is the ultimate definition of what the governance style of Rahm Emanuel has been. Instead, he's using this kind of correct analysis. I think that, you know, the 2016 election was largely about anger towards elites, and Donald Trump was able to benefit from that, whereas Hillary Clinton was seen as a representation of that elite supremacy in our society. Donald Trump was able to say he was fighting against it, and therefore now Democrats need to learn from that and rightfully call out the elites as the opponents that they are. I think that's all right and true, but when it comes to the solutions he proposes, they're just nonsensical. I mean, he says we need to try to achieve justice, and we need to reclaim middle class values and interests. It's all this muggledy-muck language that doesn't actually have any kind of policy avenues within it. And that's because he knows that what people are seizing upon is what the left is offering. And those are policies like Medicare for All, like a Green New Deal, like a jobs guarantee, the kind of things that would transform the role of government, bring more democracy, and result in Rahm Emanuel's wealthy friends like Bruce Rauner and having to pay up, having to pay their fair share in order to create a more socially just system in the United States. So that's what's going on here, I think, is that Rahm's trying to take the anger and redirect it so that people aren't bought into the message of somebody like Bernie Sanders, who famously said he was proud not to get Rahm Emanuel's endorsement back right. in 2016. That's clearly the kind of bete noire to this whole dance we're seeing, where Rahm is now a pundit and he's trying to be independent and take his views of the mayor. But he's also standing for Joe Biden out here and saying that Joe Biden is exhibiting great discipline on the campaign trail.
Well, I have a question about that, though, specifically, because, yeah, and he says, and you quote, he goes, the answer certainly isn't socialism. Which just amounts to a more, quote unquote, powerful bureaucracy or more. So basically, I mean, that. So what he's doing. OK, right. So he's totally erasing this political history. And he's maybe in a couple of meetings with people like, a totally delusional technocrat, complete creature of international financial bureaucracy like Tim Geithner. Rahm Emanuel, who is able to read a poll, was the one in the room saying, you know what? We might at least need to sort of symbolically hold some Wall Street criminality accountable. So erase the fact that he helped set the stage for all the Wall Street criminality, that he's been on the wrong side of everything. He's profited from being in Wall Street and finance personally. He's part of the same system. Okay, then we need to be against the elites, but then he doesn't follow through with supports for any actual ways of being against the elites, like supporting Medicare for All. That leads me, though, to question. And I think, probably most of it will just be these sort of generic, sort of vague bromides and sort of trying to clean up his own image. And I'm sure, of course, supporting, another, far right corporatist Democrat who is also profoundly disconnected like Joe Biden. But what it really starts to make me worried, though, when somebody of Rahm Emanuel's profile and his racial politics and his policing policies, and then you go back to the 90s, and again, it goes back to the first part of this conversation, which was that triangulation has come to be known, I think, more in the modern variant as, look, we're of the corporate class in Silicon Valley and Wall Street when it comes to economic policy. And that's why we really, that's why we oppose Medicare for All and so on. But you can trust us to, at the very least, symbolically discourse that we abhor racism and xenophobia. Not necessarily substantively, mind you. But if you start getting back into a rhetoric of let's talk about middle class anger and let's rail against the elites, however, we're not going to embrace any left populist economic agenda. Well, where does that anger go? Does the next wave of that mean that people like Rahm Emanuel, along with demonizing Ilhan Omar, start saying, I had some ideas about immigrants in the 90s. And in fact, Bill Clinton signed some incredible bills about immigrants in the 1990s. And in fact, I think Barack Obama pursued some very anti-immigrant policies and deportations as a means, again, of triangulating, but in the hopes of getting a deal. So it is a little bit different, although still setting up the apparatus and the viciousness of what we have today. But Rahm Emanuel could easily pivot this anger, if it's not going to turn into a jobs guarantee and all these other great policies, into the democratic neoliberal version of more immigrant bashing. I mean, that's the trajectory I would see.
Yeah, well, I don't think, personally, I don't think that during the 2020 election, we're going to see the Democrats move more right on immigration. That doesn't mean that, you know, their policies won't, I mean, if there's a Joe Biden administration, that their policies won't punish immigrants. I mean, we've seen Nancy Pelosi offer, you know, billions of dollars for Donald Trump's wall, where she says that, so, you know, single-payer health care is impossible. I think that that's still, that exists within the Democratic Party establishment.
You don't think in a general election that you could definitely see, if you took the spirit of this message, definitely not in a primary, but if you nominate a Joe Biden and all of a sudden there's this intellectual consensus that there is this anger out there of the middle class, quote unquote, and we know how racialized that term is for people like Rahm Emanuel, that that anger turns into some type of, again, not the same thing, but a new version of Third Way. Yes, we're going to have the right position on Dreamers, but let me tell you something. We can be pretty tough on immigrants too, because you, God knows, Joe Biden is not going to talk about NAFTA. He's not going to talk about PNTR or GATT. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but that's just the alarm bells I saw when I read that, because I was like, what anger are we talking about, Rahm?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think the real utility of this article for Rahm Emanuel is what you referenced earlier. It's an opportunity for him to try to engage with this socialist turn in the Democratic Party and try to push back against it. And in a way that it's very lazy. I mean, intellectually, I mean, he just says that socialism means more bureaucracy. That's just, that doesn't make any sense when, you know, the type of socialist policies that are gaining support are about redistributing wealth, not about, you know, creating some new government bureaucracies or anything like that. But I, you know, Rahm sees that. So he just experienced this election, as I said, where a whole slew of socialists, the most in modern American history in a single city, just took office. That's a threat to everything he spent his political career building, this whole centrist turn. And I think he feels the need right now to take that head on. And if anything, that is a sign that the left is being incredibly effective in reshaping the political terrain on which the Democratic Party has to fight right now, that somebody like Rahm Emanuel, with, as you said, his stature, has to come out and himself make an argument against socialism. At the same time, Donald Trump is trying to red bait as well. And we saw that here in elections as well. There were candidates that were running that faced red baiting, were told, you know, oh, these have some crazy vision for America that's essentially un-American. This stuff is all out there, and I think Rahm needs to take that head on. So I think we're going to see more of that. I think there's going to be more Rahm editorials and ABC News appearances and everything warning against too far of a turn to the left and saying, you know, the lessons of the past few decades show that Democrats win when they can win the suburban Pennsylvania voters, kind of the Ed Rendell approach and everything like that. Fear of there being a hard right turn in a general election with a Joe Biden, I think, should worry everybody in the Democratic Party who cares about the issues that have motivated millions of voters to come out and support Democrats in 2018 and in other years. I mean, if that would basically be giving up the energetic base of the party, if we had a candidate, a nominee, like, reneged on all these issues that the Democratic Party has claimed to have the most progressive platform ever on. That is a real possibility, though. I mean, it's not a possibility if we nominate somebody like Bernie Sanders, but if it goes in a Joe Biden direction, then sure, I mean, that's possible. And I guarantee you that Rahm Emanuel will be out there campaigning as hard as he can for Joe Biden, or at least his vision of where he wants the Democratic Party to go. And I think that we're all smart enough after seeing Rahm Emanuel's career for the past few decades to know we should not listen to anything he has to say.
Final minute here. Is there any part of the media dimension of this you want to comment on? I mean, it's not at all surprising that he would get a perch at ABC News and that he'd get a column at The Atlantic, you know, particularly under the editorship of somebody like Jeffrey Goldberg. But, you know, is there something, I mean, there is this enormous political energy on the left that is still not at all represented. In fact, it's usually, you know, belittled and resisted very, you know, vociferously in, you know, particularly like MSNBC. We know that, you know, again, there is not a liberal media. There's sort of a, you know, centrist, whatever kind of media. And then there's far extreme right media. And for what it's worth, I think you could also put on the table, too. I am not obviously I'm not drawing an equivalency, but even just the ratio of like Republican voices that are not in tune with Trumpism are frankly just disconnected from the electorate. You know, I think a lot of the elect, I think there is some centrist electorate and they're more in the Democratic Party, like it or not. And then there is people on the left, and then there's people very much in this, you know, nationalist right. And so you still have these like huge clusters of people that are all over these Sunday shows that still, it's like we're just in a different time zone with them, even regardless of, you know, all the obvious ideological disagreement we have. It's just like you're not even approximating what is sort of politically out there, both in very bad ways and in very good ways. And Rahm Emanuel just seems to just so perfectly exemplify, like, of course a hugely unpopular mayor of Chicago, of course somebody whose whole career has been a failure by not only the human metrics that they wouldn't care about, but even just like enduring power metrics. Well, of course he'll be there because, you know, he has money and he just has ticks in a resume or something. It's just kind of depressing.
Well, people in positions of extreme wealth and political power in our society tend to always fail upward. I mean, we've seen that time and time again.
Right.
There's really no other way to see what's happened with Rahm. He should be, you know, hiding out in some bunker planning his, you know, return or something. Instead, he's being elevated on all these mainstream media outlets, which I think goes to show how they view politics. And he was hired to do this. You know, this is the kind of retrograde, backwards looking takes he's spelling out in The Atlantic, and I'm sure he will soon be doing over all the cable news shows. That's exactly the kind of voice they want to elevate. That's what these media outlets think that America needs right now. And to be honest, in The Atlantic, there's plenty of liberal readers who might be open to a more left-wing approach to politics that subscribe to The Atlantic. And that's kind of the audience for this past piece, I think. And to say, no, 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 don't go too far. I, you know, represent this era where Democrats were doing great, and we need to make sure that we're, you know, providing for the great middle, and we need to, you know, argue against ourselves to the point that we give up any hope for a, you know, future that doesn't look like the past. And that's what's being offered this election by the Rahm Emanuels of the world and the Joe Bidens of the world, I think, is to a return to normalcy, to something before. When was the last time a Democrat ever won running on returning to the past? You know, if there ever was a change election with this psychotic president in office, you'd think it would be 2020, and that Democrats would want to embrace choosing a new future rather than returning to an era of, you know, America is already great when the Midwest is being destroyed by the same type of free market fundamentalist policies that Rahm Emanuel and his ilk have gone for in the past. So I think that that's really what this all comes down to. Is it's not an apology tour for Rahm Emanuel. It's his attempt at to retain relevancy and to try to shift the party back in his centrist direction, the same direction we've seen be, as I said, fully discredited.
The piece is no one should ever listen to anything Rahm Emanuel has to say about politics by Miles Kampf Lawson. You can read it in all of Miles' work at In These Times. Miles, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Take care, man. All right, folks. Rahm Emanuel, not good. He really is like extraordinarily not good. Just an utterly loathsome figure in politics, and someone that you're going to have to see on your TV a lot if you choose to rot your brain by watching politics on television, which, good time to read Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman, I would say. Medium is the message, right, Matt? Media studies scholar, Matt Leck?
Oh, that's McLuhan.
I know, it's McLuhan. Okay. Well, Postman is Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Yep.
And McLuhan's the medium, the message, right?
The deep cut for Postman is Technopoly, which is about, if memory serves, basically the technocracy and that sort of stuff, which is...
He was good. I read him a lot in college.
Yeah, I knew that Rahm Emanuel was bad before you did that interview, but now I have some very detailed talking points, so thank you.
Who are you meeting that still is like, well, you know, Rahm Emanuel said that blah, blah, blah. Family dinners?
I don't really meet them IRL. Sometimes I meet them online.
They have donuts in their usernames.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Where did that donut thing... Actually, you know what? I don't care. I was going to ask where the donut thing
came from.
They're
just disrespecting Nina Turner.
But I don't care. Why would you disrespect... You know what? The better somebody is, the more those people get triggered by them.
Why would you pick a foodstuff to represent centrism that has an empty center?
Indeed.
Look, the center's not good, folks.
There's nothing there, folks.
Like, Jim Hightower.
All the good stuff's around the center.
There's nothing in the middle of the road but yellow stripes and dead armadillos. It's true. It's an old book. All right, folks, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show happens. That's how you get the real talk about a scumbag like Rahm Emanuel. And you get it for less than a cup of coffee a day. Check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Check out all of the mid-rolls, check out all of our sponsors today, Grove and DoorDash. On the Michael Brooks show this weekend, we're doing a think tank on capitalist realism, the constriction of our imaginations, and Jeff Bezos in space. The following week, we have an in-depth illicit history of Hezbollah and Lebanese politics with Dr. Drew McHale from Queen's University in Ireland. No new show next week for TMBS. We are off. But there's a huge catalog to catch up on, and now a highly clipped YouTube channel with a huge amount of content, including illicit histories of Iran, updates on Argentina, on Algeria, Biggie Smalls, artistry, and the myth of the Roaring 90s. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, patreon.com/TMBS. Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, Andy is back from his travels with several interviews. This is out now. So he interviewed Isabel Diaz Torres from the Anarchist Biblioteca Abra in Cuba. And this guy is a Cuban anarchist who was actually arrested after he did the interview with Andy for staging a protest. I believe he's been released, yeah. Okay. But he staged a protest against homophobia, and the Cuban state doesn't really let you stage your own protests. So that's interesting, and I think we're going to add some updates in the description. We also have Simón Rodríguez from Partido Socialismo y Libertad of Venezuela, who's part of the left opposition to Maduro. We also have an interview with a producer of this interesting podcast called Resonance Audio Zine, where they read to you out of anarchist zines. It's kind of like ASMR crossed with politics. And lastly, Philip Wall's letter of Red May, who wraps everything up with his story of backpacking to Chile in 1973 during the coup. Wow. And I was trying to listen to it on my way here, but my fucking dongle kept going out, and I hate it so much.
Ooh, those dongles, man.
What is a dongle?
The thing that you have to connect to your phone that doesn't have a normal audio jack so you can plug your headphones into it.
It's so
those
annoying.
Plastic things?
They break immediately.
Yeah,
they last about a month and a half, and then you have to buy a new one. And guess what? Incredibly those are wasteful. Very profitable for your phone companies. Yeah. They make lots of money off of selling you new ones of those.
Because it's not good.
Oh, and you know what? I also want to plug, we did an episode with Swampside Chats, our comrades, the gayest, highest communist podcast probably in the world. And we talked about communization theory, and that's some galaxy brain shit. And that's going to be out on their feed first, so they can pick up some listeners from that, and eventually on our feed.
Sorry for the profanity, people. Majority Report listeners don't like profanity.
Oh, my bad. Sam's not here.
Cool. It's true. Matt?
Literary Hangover. Soon I'm going to release the Margaret Fuller episode. I've been calling her like an early socialist. She had these, kind of the first podcaster, she had these things called the Conversations that a lot of women, they're women only, basically for actual safe space reasons. But so women could have intellectual conversations. She was doing that in Boston. And that's actually what sort of led to a lot of her writings on women in the 19th century.
and her editing The Dial, which was a transcendentalist paper.
Oh yeah.
But she had these conversations where they would actually talk about like women in Greek mythology or women from Roman times or basically women throughout history that were remembered for traits that at her time in the 1830s and 40s were ascribed to only men. So she was kind of like decoupling these sort of masculine feminine binary, saying, well, throughout history, if you look at things, these women can have these traits as well. There's nobody that's purely masculine or purely feminine.
Sounds pretty cool.
She's very Margaret Fuller. It's a travesty. We don't know more about her because she was amazing.
Definitely. Guys, just to let you know, I know people are very excited about the IMs, but hopefully I'll have it figured out in the break. I also want to mention that tickets are available and they're moving extremely fast, and we announced it extremely early, so I would do this soon, to the TMBS live show August 24th at Lincoln Hall in Chicago. Get your tickets today. We'll see you in the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd, don't you see?